Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're here to talk about Season 3, Episode 2, titled Dark Wings, Dark Words. What do you think of this episode?
I feel like a chapter two of the premiere, because now we get to see what's been going on with Bran, what's been going on with Brienne and Jaime, what happened to Theon after he got his ass knocked out at Winterfell. Like, all the open questions we had after last episode is kind of like put the rest in this one. So I thought it was super interesting, and there's a lot of interesting character work that you forget about, like the little detail of that's kind of a recurring detail in the television series of Joffrey being kind of like a little fashionista.
Okay.
Like, he's very involved with wedding preparations and remodeling and his wardrobe
and his fancy weapon.
which I think is an interesting little detail for him. Like, that he despite being such a monstrous person, he cares so much about his presentation and looking like a particular way.
It does feel like he cares about that for himself. Like, a lot of people with that fashion forward view kind of care about that as how they present to other people, but he's and like pleasing other people, but I don't feel like that's him, right? He's doing it because he feels a certain way about himself,
right?
And he wants to represent that to other people.
Yeah, I wonder how he got it. Like, I feel like there's a part of me that says that this was like the one lesson that Tywin droned on about in his youth that he picked up, like, you should, you know, dress for the job you want, not for the job you have, or something. Like, that's the one thing Joffrey, like, oh, I'll take that nugget, ding, because
right, and everything else can go out the other ear.
He does look regal when he's not being slapped by his mom or Tyrion. He does tend to look the part of a handsome boy king.
And without a single flower.
No, get those flowers out of here. It's bad enough I'm marrying one. I don't want them on my fancy costume. What'd you think?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. It's a, you know, chapter. It's a part two for the first episode almost. Game of Thrones is really good at that, at juggling however many characters it needs to at one time to feel like you're engaged in every story at once. You know, huge cast. It's a big world. And they always manage to kind of keep all those balls in the air.
Right.
It's one of the things I really appreciate about this show.
And it never feels like a cost-cutting measure, although I know that's part of it, because they've got like a globe-spanning camera crew and everything's isolated and there's A units, B units, probably down to DEF units. But it never feels like that. When Game of Thrones is firing on all cylinders, it feels like everything is just like kept up in the air perfectly. And then when they do zoom down to a single focus episode, watch the fuck out. Because shit's going to go down, and it feels very rewarding. So yeah, we're in classic peak Game of Thrones, and it just feels effortless. Everything is just going, just loping ahead effortlessly.
Yeah, I agree. All right, are we ready to get into the recap?
We are ready to get into the recap. Before we get into the recap of the episode, I wanted to run down some housekeeping, some stuff that's going on here at Bald Move. We are watching HBO's Sharp Objects, another HBO show. It's a miniseries based on the novel, same novel by Gillian Flynn. I'm really enjoying it. It's a great little, I'd say it's Southern Gothic, but it's more like Midwest Gothic. Murder mystery, maybe some supernatural twist in it. I'll have to see. Keep my eye on that Lady in White. We're also about to embark on our voyage of season four with Better Call Saul, or Better Cast Saul podcast. We'll be doing, I think that comes back like the first week of August, and we'll have a season preview probably the week before that. Definitely the week before that. That releases on a Monday, so we'll have our podcast out on Wednesday, rather. We're also doing, back in the swing of things, our first run Bald Movies. Last week we saw the very enjoyable, crazy action pick, Skyscraper, starring The Rock. This week, I'm going to be watching Mamma Mia 2. Here we go again with my wife, Cecily, who's a big fan. We'll be talking about that tonight, Thursday. We've also moved our Twitch TV streams from Monday and Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to Tuesday and Thursday. If you want to see Jim and I hang out and play video games and kind of chat with us, keep us company. Oh, we're also getting back into our commissioned podcast. We just released Pride and Prejudice, 2005. Version of that. Paul Kilgore commissioned that for his wife. I thought it was pretty cool. And finally, I want to mention, we're still a couple weeks left in the book.baldmove.com campaign. This is me doing a Kickstarter to raise money to professionally publish this book that I wrote with a religious scholar about the religions of Game of Thrones and Westeros, called Gods of Thrones. We actually completed our funding last week, so thank you for everybody that's backed. But there's still some other things going on. We're coming up with some stretch goals to try to see how cool we can make the project. And you can still get some really cool merch and some cool reward levels. Check it out, book.baldmove.com.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right, we start off with Bran dreaming that he's walking through the woods, and he tries to kill a raven while his brothers give him some advice on how to do it, and they laugh when he fails. Bran calls his father's name into the wind as Jojen, or some mysterious boy at this point.
Don't want to get in the mid-episode spoilers.
Yeah, right. You've seen this episode by now. Unless you're listening to the podcast in sequential order with the scenes.
That's the only recommended way. Like, yes, you should watch a scene, pause, listen to our commentary, watch a scene, pause, or play it simultaneously, because our analysis tend to be one-to-one the length of the episodes. That'll probably work out well.
Also, they sync up. I don't know if you're aware of this, but if you play them backwards, it all syncs up. And you have an out-of-body experience.
Yep, Tyrion's a giant, Hodor's...
You see Bran's dream in your head.
Tyrion's a giant, Hodor's a dwarf. It gets crazy.
When he wakes up... Actually, Jojen shows up and tells him that Bran... tells Bran that he can't kill this raven because he is the raven. And then Bran wakes up and Asha really doesn't want to hear about this dream. She, I don't know for what reason, she maybe is superstitious, but she insists they have to move. Because she has a bad feeling about the whole thing.
Well, I mean, she's a wildling woman in this feudal culture. She's superstitious as fuck. As a co-author of a book on Game of Thrones religion, I'm comfortable saying that Asha is superstitious and kind of afraid of her own shadow, and for good reason. Like, there's shit she's not understand. This guy is, you know, like the Lord of the North just got his house pulled down after he got his head cut off. His son's having these weird dreams with three-eyed crows and wizards, and she says, like, if there's other intelligences in your dreams, kind of like, who else could be watching? You know, and plus, we also found in this episode that something the wildlings know that is not common knowledge in the North is that there are aerial drones in effect.
Mm-hmm.
So just because you think you're alone doesn't mean necessarily you are. So it's like staying on the move seems like a prudent course of action.
Yeah, and what's common to all the Stark children but Sansa at this point is they're all on the run, you know? They're all being hunted by forces, both human and potentially non-human.
Right.
So they have every right to be paranoid and scared. Anything else in that scene, or shall we move
just Hodor
on?
Like, you know, being concerned, you know, coming in Hodor when Bran is like having a bad dream, and then when he says it's fine, Hodor. I can't get enough of Hodor.
All right, Talisa is flirting with Rob in a weird way. She's doing it by calling him a grim, bearded, stinking barbarian. I guess he's into that. Because they start
That's
to make
Cecily
out.
Likes calling me.
Yeah. But they're interrupted by Roose, who has two messages, one from River Run, one from Winterfell. Rob goes to his mother with the news that her father has died, but even more bad news, Winterfell has been burned and Bran and Rickon are missing.
Yeah, that's so Dark Wings, Dark Words, if you didn't know, is a quote that Ned liked to say, especially a lot in the books, referring to the fact that if you're sending a raven, it's not normal. I mean, sometimes it's like, hey, the king had a baby and welcome princess so and so into the world.
New marriage, yeah.
But mostly it's the crops have failed and we're shit out of luck, or this lord has invaded your lands, or, you know, the citadel says winter is coming finally, father. You're right. So and we see here you get double ravens, double barrels of bad news.
Yeah.
Death of a grandfather, and oh, by the way, your ancestral family throne is been burnt mm-hmm. up, and your
kids are missing.
Your brother's dead, probably.
Probably. I would also argue Light Wings, Dark Words too, because Light Wings herald the winter.
Yeah.
And the winter is not a great time, especially for the North.
No.
So just Wings, Dark Words.
Right.
Honestly.
Yeah. Just anything that starts. Yeah. Any Wings that bear words just should be always treated with skepticism.
All right, then we move on to a short scene of Theon being... he's been left by his men and captured, and he's now being tortured. Nothing to see here.
By men unknown.
Yeah.
You don't really know what affiliation they have, and that's kind of a mystery.
Not yet. And not by the end of this episode, I assume.
No, right? Yeah. I think we're gonna have to unfold the mystery over the next weeks ahead.
Yep. All right, then we go to Jaime complaining about how boring the journey with Brienne is. She doesn't talk, doesn't make jokes. She's just... walking
a giant toe-headed plank.
And they talk about Renly, and Brienne gets pretty angry when Jaime makes light of his sexual proclivities, and a man just walking through the woods meets them, and he kind of walks on, and Jaime says, hey, we need to kill this guy because he's essentially seen my face. And Brienne refuses, which will come back later to bite them.
Yeah, I knew that it did, but I was surprised that it was at the end of this episode.
Yeah, yeah, it happened really quick.
But it's like, man, the poor guy. I mean, what do you do? You can't, like, Brienne can't kill this guy on a suspicion.
Mm-hmm.
But it was ultimately the right thing to do. But, I mean, it's interesting conversation, like... You know, she's like, well, he's innocent. And he's like, well, are the Stark girls any more innocent? And you're trying to get there, secure their freedom. Like, Jamie's a real fucking devil on her shoulder here. Yeah. I also enjoyed the sparring because, yeah, he calls her giant toe-headed plank, but she comes back with a cool Kingslayer, which is a direct insult on his honor and manhood and all that other stuff, which he then escalates by talking shit about Renly. I don't know. Like, I'm not saying Brienne's bringing any of this stuff on, but, like, she spars with him like an equal, and he treats her as such. And then later on, they spar, you know, for real. So,
and it does feel like Jaime here is, you know, not just picking these fights to pick these fights. He's learning a lot about Brienne through these, you know, conversations. He learns a lot about her relationship with Renly, more about her relationship with Catelyn, stuff like that, that he could potentially use to manipulate her and get out of this situation he's in, you know?
He is. He's feeling for openings, and he later finds one at the end of the episode as she lets her guard down for a micro instant, and he's got a blade, so...
Yeah.
But I really like the... I don't know, what do you call it? The opposite of chemistry. You know what is something that
I don't...
there's a learned phrase for that which halts a reaction, like a moderator or something. I don't know, but yeah, it's that. It's the he's the it's the cold lead blanket of chemistry.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's great.
All right, we move on to Joffrey. He gets pissed at his tailor when he tries to dress him in flowers, and Cersei is there, and she asks what Joffrey thinks of Margaery, and he's not really interested in talking about Margaery or really anything. She tries to offer some advice to him, but he is just too shitty of a human being to hear it. He thinks he knows everything. I'm questioning like what Cersei is doing, sort of openly insulting Margaery, like talking about how little fabric she wears and essentially calling her a whore to her future husband here. Like, that doesn't seem like a good strategy, Cersei.
It doesn't, but it does work because Joffrey then, like, you can tell he's bothered by it, even though he pretends not to, because he then probes Margaery along those lines, and she easily outwits him and tells him what he wants to hear. But I feel like that, like, I don't want to take anything away from Cersei's skillful manipulation of her son, because I think she was really taken aback last season by how quickly she lost control of the situation. So now she's trying to be less matronly and more, well, seductive isn't the right word, but sly.
Yeah.
And like, or almost satanic, like, you know, like when the serpent came to Eve, he didn't be like, yo, eat this apple. He was like, is it true that your God, your father, told you that, you know, it's like all this weird Socratic method stuff, or she's just, I'm just asking questions, you know. I'm not hurling accusations, I'm just trying to, you know, and
just planting seeds.
It does and it works. Why do you think he doesn't want flowers? Because I feel like as a fashionista himself, he would admire the fusion of the Lannister like sigil with the Tyrell sigil, but maybe he's just so monomaniacal that he doesn't want, even as he acknowledges that with the Tyrell strength will crush the Northerners, he doesn't ever want to give that credit where it's due publicly.
I don't even know that it's about the Tyrells. I think it's simply him wanting to present strength and power, and he views flowers as very feminine and weak.
Okay.
I think he's just that much of a shit.
All right. That's possible. Because he did, like, I did notice the guy came back with, like, a very Lannister crimson red sash.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I think Joffrey's outfit is pretty badass. Like, the base fabric he's wearing is beautiful. It looks pretty awesome. But, man, he's got some just... Cersei has to swallow river shit to make this one or two points, because like that line where, you know, she's kind of trying to like, you know, why'd she marry Renly? And he's like, because she was told to. That's what intelligent women do.
Yeah.
really a big rebuke of Cersei, who's maybe not the smartest, but she's also not the dumbest. And
sure,
I think smarter and more perceptive than Joffrey.
Easily.
So the irony here is pretty thick. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he doesn't need to do anything. Doesn't need to do anything except for get a more Lannister shade of red on him, and then he'll be fine.
Yeah, I do like the way that Margaery and Cersei's battle over Joffrey is taking place in these isolated, you know, events with Joffrey. You know, they don't want this out in the open. They don't want to battle each other face to face. They want to do it behind closed doors.
Right.
And influence this impressionable young person.
Yeah, no, it seems like he goes with whatever advice he kind of got last.
Right.
So.
All right, we move on to Shay trying to caution Sansa to be careful around Littlefinger. He might be looking for sex or maybe even other favors that she can't perceive yet. She tells Sansa to let her know if he tries anything, and Loras shows up to escort Sansa to Lady Olenna and Margaery in the gardens. And Olenna is extremely frank in her discussion of Renly and his quest for the throne. And then she sort of pumps Sansa for her opinion of Joffrey. And Sansa says all the right things, which greatly disappoints Olenna. But when the subject of her father comes up, she cracks and she finally tells Olenna that Joffrey is a monster.
Yeah, like, I think Sophie Turner did a great job of portraying this really broken child trying to decide if this is yet another trick or if this is something that she can trust and believe in, and then trying to like dance on both of those, like saying something crazy and then trying to excuse her traitor's blood. And like, I thought it was good and honestly pitiable, her performance here. And I mean, this is our first introduction to Lady Olenna.
It is. It's brilliant.
It's memorable.
Yeah, I love her.
The whole, like, her abuse of the household staff, her dismissal of her entire family, calling her son a fathead, calling her father, like her husband wandered off a cliff while falconing and died that way.
Uh-huh.
Like, just how...
And Loras is doing the same.
Like, right, like how she just can't get over how incompetent the male members of her family are. And yeah. You gotta wonder, like, so how much power does she really have? Is she just, like, cursed to be this perceptive woman who has lived long enough to be able to see how the game's played but been unable to play it? Is she the real power behind Tyrell? If so, why is Highgarden such a fuck-up place, you know? Why
sure,
is all this shit happening? Like, I think it's...
Maybe because she's been marginalized, you know,
right.
As much as Woon are in that world and in today's world.
No, I think she's a fascinating character, and Miss Riggs really brings her to life. The phrase, there's no squirting the cream back up the cow's udders. Like, it's really funny.
It is. I also noticed everybody in this scene is playing their part. You know, Sansa is desperately trying to play her part and then, I guess, fails at the end. But Margaery is playing her part. There's a little bit of, like, good cop, not so good cop going on. Like, when Margaery says, you know, oh, grandmother, can't you see she's so scared? Like, back off on her a little bit.
Right.
You know, Olenna doesn't. She goes right in.
Do you think there's any element? Do you think that the, like, just from what we know now, I guess there's not enough information for it. This is more of a spoiler speculation, but I think it's fascinating to wonder, like, yes, it's performance, but is there any real sympathy or empathy for Sansa? Like, would they help her, and why? Would they help her because, as Tyrion later says, she's a handsome face with the old family name, and you never know when that might be handy.
Sure.
Like, you know, if we can get her married to one of the Tyrell boys, that would solidify our, you know, place in the realm, because obviously the North would have a lot of affection for the Stark name.
Could there be some kind of mediation between the Starks and the Lannisters?
Right.
Half the family is Stark, half the family is Lannister.
I mean, that's one of the interesting questions I think about, like, even Margaery, is, like, how much of her act is a put on and how much of, because she's a Chimera. Like, if she's married to this closeted gay man, she's all about, like, hey, we can get my brother involved and you know, grease the wheels if we need to, like, and if she's got a murderous psychopath, and hey, I might want to dabble in some light murderous psychopathy. Like, how much of, what is the real Margaery? And I feel like that's a question that's going to take a long time to answer and a lot more observation.
Yeah, and when she does things like get out of her
procession
there,
right.
And meet with the children, the orphans, is that the real Margaery, or is that also an act?
Because you know that, like,
for the people.
Right, because that's kind of Tyrell marketing. Hey, look at us. We got the wagons of food and we're coming in. Like, don't tell your friends.
Right.
Tyrells are the ones with bringing home the bacon.
Yeah.
Not these land. So yeah, like, what is her? If you peel all the artifice away, what is she? Where are her affections? What does she really think? Is she just raw naked power and ambition? It's interesting. And Natalie Dormer is just inscrutable in the way she smiles and the flash of her eyes, and she's good.
I do feel like Margaery is playing a slightly deeper game than Cersei is playing, in that Cersei is blinded by this Joffrey conundrum and trying to win the affection of her child. But Margaery is doing both that and winning the affection of the people at the same time. She's almost stealing the loyalty of King's Landing away from the Lannisters.
I feel like but Cersei's short-sighted, because I feel like the real play would be to just let your son be infatuated by this woman. You know how capricious and mercurial Joffrey is. Eventually, she'll piss him off, and then you slip in with the, like, you know, the poison you start pouring in his ear.
Yeah. Maybe help her along in making a couple mistakes.
Right, exactly. But Cersei doesn't have the patience for the long game, and she's in a position she might never have been before, where, you know, she's not the fairest in the land, and she's being supplanted. And, you know, the last time that happened, it was a dead woman, like, that her husband was carrying a torch for, and she didn't really give a shit because she didn't really care about that guy anyway.
Yeah.
Now, I it's
you think
it's,
she's gonna run to daddy for a little bit of help here with Joffrey.
I mean, that would be another smart play. Just let, you know, let Tywin bring this boy king to heel if he thinks it's so easy. And boy, that would be an awesome sight.
All right, we go to another quick scene where Lord Karstark tells Robb that his grandfather's funeral is essentially a distraction from the real mission, which in his eyes is revenge, and that he lost the war the day he married Talisa. Some tough truth here from
Dark
Lord
words.
Karstark.
Yeah. I love the thing about speak my mind, your grace. Uh-huh. And he's like, oh, you haven't been speaking your mind?
Right. And then he drops some real mind speaking on him.
Right.
About
I mean,
his wife.
That's the thing, like, him saying if this is about revenge, then I have faith. Essentially, like, I no longer believe in a militarily achievable objective.
Yeah.
I can get on board just fucking killing as many Lannisters as I can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty dispiriting to hear if you're this guy's king.
Yeah. They just don't have the people to do it.
Especially
I don't
now
think he
that,
understands that Robb.
Right.
He doesn't think that Robb has the will to do it or the ability to do it.
Right.
And so he's
and
lost
this is
faith.
A boy king, and he's being Twitter-pated by his new, lover. Like, yeah. Roose is walking in on the making out. Like, that's got to be... Like, it's not great politics that Robb's playing here.
Yeah. I guarantee Tywin isn't making out with anybody.
No. Nope. Other than his balance sheet, maybe.
So after that all happens, Talisa sees Catelyn making her weird dream catcher thing. What are these things?
Seven-sided dream catcher is what I wrote about.
Okay. Cool.
Because this is a scene invented for the show. It does not appear in the books.
Oh. Do those things that she's making at all appear?
I can't.
Because there was one over Bran's bed. I remember seeing that in season
right,
one.
Right. I mean, it's been a while since I've read these early books, so I wouldn't stake my reputation as serious Westerosi religious scholar if I say either way, but
okay,
it does feel like something that a mother would do, and mm-hmm. like knit this thing that represents the seven and try to get it's just kind of like hanging across over the bed, like try to get any help where you can get. And I love, I think Kat's very one note in the book. It's hard to be sympathetic for her viewpoint of John, but this kind of humanizes, like, she realizes what a shit she's being,
mm-hmm.
but she's so consumed with jealousy of her husband and this infidelity that he committed that she can't, even knowing what a shit it makes her. Now she said that I was the worst woman who lived.
Uh-huh. And keep that in mind for the Shay and Tyrion scene coming up later,
right,
where she's extraordinarily jealous as well.
Right.
But
she knows she's being a shit. She just can't mm-hmm. help it. Like even her piousness, which by all accounts seems intact and legit, she'll forsake a sworn oath through the gods mm-hmm. to keep being spiteful to Jon, which must like a feedback loop, right? Like this character's bringing out the worst parts of you. How hard is it to transfer the blame on that person for that? Like, man, imagine how awesome my life would be, and I'd be the perfect mom, and now I got the stain on me, and I can't wash it out no matter what. I mean, she's still a shit and the worst woman who ever lived, but the self-awareness, I thought, I really appreciated. And it gave a nice little moment between her and Talisa.
And she blames herself, most importantly, for all that's happening now with Bran and Rickon. She blames herself and essentially blames her, not keeping her promise to love John on what's happening now.
Yeah, and it's interesting because, I often wonder, man, what would a Stark's family history have been like if John had been legitimized, if he was John Stark, if Ned went to the king and been like, yo, man, I want you to legitimize my bastard, Bobby B would be like, right on, Ned,
mm-hmm.
I'll legitimize, I got a bunch of blank legitimization forms.
Let's keep this train rolling.
I got
so many bastards. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go hunting birds, not boars. He would have done it. And what a difference that, and instead of John brooding in the back, anytime there's an official dinner and being kind of, partitioned off from the family, being one of them. And, what a big difference that would have made. But then mm-hmm. you also think what would have happened if John had been left at Winterfell, if it would have been him garrisoning it instead of Bran, would it ever, there's all kinds of cool what if games you can think about that, but
mm-hmm.
She didn't do it. She didn't do it. Not even after promising the gods.
Nope. Shame on her. All right, we go up to Mance and John up beyond the wall, and Mance is impressing upon John the difficulty of uniting the Wildling clans and his secret weapon that he uses, which is the truth. They're all going to die if they don't get south.
Right.
Then John finds out what a warg is when he sees a man scouting through the eyes of a bird, and he reports dead crows at the Fist of the First Men.
Old Moral Oral with the eagle worgen.
Moral Oral?
That's the guy's name, Oral.
Okay. I didn't know that, but all right.
I like how economical in a couple sentences, they really kind of impress upon you the achievement that Mance has. And it's some achievement. It's essentially someone saying, well, you can do whatever you want. I'm walking south. And then everybody being like, oh boy, what if we're wrong? And falling in line. But like he mentions, like, there's seven different tongues, different species, cannibals, like, all these things have been welded together just for the sheer fear of staying behind and dying, you know, in onesies and twosies, instead of risking it all by essentially bum rushing the wall.
And it's often true in Game of Thrones, but I think it's represented really well within Mance, the man who plays Mance. I don't know his name.
Ciarán Hinds, right?
Sure. Sounds like it could be an Irish name or something. But he is a very serious man. You know, the actor who's playing him plays him with a lot of seriousness, someone to be taken seriously at all times. So when he says, we're all going to die unless we go south, I instantly believe him as a viewer, although I've seen a lot of stuff. But you can see the other people looking at him and saying, okay, this is a man who doesn't fuck around. We need to follow him south.
And it also reinforces, like, when he says, hey, John, I like you, but it's going to be super easy for me to kill you if you prove false.
Sure.
Like, that also, like, nothing that he says is about politics or flattery. It's just straight the truth as he sees it and as his will can enforce it. And that's not common in Game of Thrones, especially amongst the, like, antagonists that we meet.
Right.
That tend to be Lannisters or Littlefingers or Varyses who talk out of all possible sides of their mouth.
No, it does seem like the Northerners are a little better in that
respect.
They
are. They
don't play the game quite as much.
Yeah. To their detriment.
Yeah,
but yeah,
most of the time. Mm-hmm.
They don't participate in the broader politics. They just keep their own weird religion. And they don't truck with knights. Like, there's all... Yeah. They hold themselves apart.
I guess the farther north you go, the more truthful they get.
That's true. Truth is cold.
It sure is.
And it blows coldest up north.
Sam gets some truth in this next scene where Rast tells him that he has no right to be here when better men have died, and basically says, stop walking and die. So Sam does.
Because that's what he wants to do.
Slumps down, yeah.
Like, nothing Rast is this guy, this asshole's name. Nothing Rast says here is necessarily untrue. It's just incredibly unkind, and it's not much leave no man behind,
right,
which pisses off Jor.
Yeah, it does, and Jor sees, you know, what's going on here, and he forbids Sam to die.
Right.
And then he makes Rast responsible for him on death, or penalty of death. So...
Yeah, because that's a thing, like... It's not just unkind, it is totally true. And, like, even Grin and Dolores Ed struggle to, like, sugarcoat that. Well, Ed doesn't even try.
No, he doesn't.
The only difference is they do care. Like, in absence of a mortal threat, they don't want to see Sam die. But
right.
He's also a real liability, and he needs to dig deep to make it out of the situation.
Mm-hmm. And whether or not Gior's little speech here can do that, we'll find out, I guess.
I wish Jor would be like, Sam, I'm as fat as you, and I'm 40 years older. Get up and start walking.
Yeah.
They don't call me the old ballerina. They call me the old bear. Now get the fuck up.
All right. Bran wakes up to Asha and Summer, spooked by something in the woods. And this boy from Bran's dream shows up along with his sister. He calms Summer, introduces them as Jojen and Mira, and says they have very far to go.
What a great introduction. I mean, the fact
that
we saw him in a vision is arresting enough, but the fact that he can just instantly pacify Summer, this fearsome direwolf.
No, all of this, like, those two things, the fog, the strange nature of, like, Asha going off and leaving him, Bran and, or Rickon and Hodor not being there, mm-hmm. it all kind of melds together to make this feel like it might be a dream
right,
the whole time.
Right,
it's really
right.
effective at like making you question, is what I'm seeing happening? Or is this another dream that he has faux waken up from?
Right.
Really good.
I think this marks like the sixth or seventh, maybe eighth time I've seen this episode. And it took me this many times to realize the way they staged this. Bran is looking at Asha jacking Jojen.
Mm-hmm.
All right. And Mira sneaks up on Asha, and Bran is seeing the, like, he's got a 180 degree view. So,
right.
like, apparently Mira either just decloaked off her starboard bow, or Bran watched her slowly approach from, like, dozens of yards away.
Maybe she used,
and
like,
said nothing.
The Tusken Raider thing where they just travel in single file.
Right. Yeah,
so he
yeah.
couldn't see her.
Yeah,
she was just directly
she was hiding
behind
in the
Asha.
Shadow. That's hilarious. But, like, you know what I'm saying? Like, Bran's like,
yeah.
is he paralyzed in fear? He's like, you know what? I'm going to see how this plays out.
Right.
That struck me as funny. It's a little Walking Dead where, like, you know, they're in the middle of a forest and, oh my god, six zombies, like, just mind their own business. Oh my god, this teenage girl took me by arrow or knife point.
Yeah, and Bran is like, you know, surprised and disturbed and also curious, I think, of this person he's seen in his dream.
Well, I think he also, because of his bond with Summer, like, not just like a pet bond, but the psychic bond, the fact that Summer instinctively trusts him, I think, does a lot of work for Bran to, like, feel like, oh, I can drop my guard a bit. This isn't a terrible situation.
All right, then Gendry questions why Arya didn't use her Jaqen Death Witches to end the war, to which Arya has no real defense.
This is meta commentary aimed directly at the fans.
Oh, I've definitely asked the same question before.
Yeah. Like, is this the wisest? And, I think we talk about this a lot last season. They're all individually indefensible, but, like, this is the, you know, this is a wide to stormtroopers. They're the most precise soldiers in the galaxy, can't hit the broadside of a barn. This is the meta commentary that fans like to, like, why couldn't the Eagles just fly Frodo to crack a Mount Doom? Why all the walking? Like, okay, that's because we have to have a story, jackasses. Write a better
one. Yeah, and it's, you know, I think the defense we mounted last time is it's a scared little girl doing what she needs to do, what she can think of in the moment to escape the situation she's in. And she essentially says that, you know, well, he got us out of Harrenhal.
Right, the first one was a test, the second one was a desperation, and the third one was arguably wishing for more wishes to get you out of the immediate danger situation.
Yeah.
So, you know.
There's your defense.
Right.
Gendry. So she realizes that they're lost, and she suggests they go to Riverrun. But before they can make a move, several members of the Brotherhood Without Banners find them and say that they're headed to Harrenhal and demand that the children come with them. In stylish fashion, too. That bow guy, I don't remember his name, but he puts up a really good shot.
the bow guy. Angi.
Yeah.
Angi. It's kind of like angry, only with the guy.
It gets hop high moving.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Is this the first time we've heard the Reigns of Castamere?
The lyrics to it, I would say certainly.
I think so
too. I don't
know
about the melody.
This is like the Lannisters' unofficial theme song. The backstory here is that Tywin took over from his father Tytus, and Tytus ran a loose ship. And he let his lords kind of, like, run roughshod over him. And when he died and Tywin took over, they didn't know what to make of him. And this particular lord that reported to the Lannisters, the Reigns, R-E-Y-E-N-S, I think. R-E-Y-N-E, yeah. Tywin said, you know, called his banners and, like, asked for his loyalty, the guy's like, why should I? The lyrics are like, cause the coat of this house is a red lion on like a silver background, which is kind of like the opposite of the, and he's like, I'm a lion too. And my claws are sharp as you. And the moral of the story is Tywin destroys him and destroys his house and pulls it down and makes the family a pariah that's just extinct from the land as a way of like saying, yo, under new management. And yeah, so some singer put some pen to paper, and the rest is history. But
Tywin's pretty proud of this song.
Probably. Yeah. I don't think he's trying to suppress it at all.
No.
This is good marketing for him.
Very.
But yeah, you'll hear this motif a lot. This is kind of like the Imperial March for Darth Vader.
Yeah. All right, we go to Shay, who surprises Tyrion by showing up in his chambers. Tyrion's worried that his father will find out, and she says she's worried about Sansa and that they have to protect her. Of course, she gets too distracted to finish this conversation when Tyrion comments on Sansa's beauty, and the conversation ends with Tyrion trying to convince her it's too dangerous for her to be here while she's going down on him.
Yeah.
So this is why Shay sucks. This whole scene is why Shay sucks and blows. The idea that a man isn't allowed to admit that there is that other women might be beautiful.
Oh, yeah.
It just infuriates me. Like,
right.
Look, I'm under no idea that I am the most handsome man in the world.
Right.
And for someone to suggest that fact to me
right.
is not news, and I'm not offended by it. Like,
right.
It blows my mind. This stuff I hate. I hate right. it so much.
Yeah, no. So my question is this... I think this is a put on. Like, this is a way, because Tyrion has been very stubborn about letting Shay do the things that Shay wants, and this is she is now doing this wounded thing as it's essentially Margaery, only on a much smaller scale. She is
it's obviously manipulation.
Attempting to manipulate. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, so because the thing is, like, I don't think she's really that unaware. And I guess that's the thing.
I would hope not, yeah.
That's the thing. On my second time through this, looking at it, it's like, I used to think, like, geez, Shay, what does Tyrion see in her? I still say that, but, like, I think it's more, this is an intentional effect that she's trying to have on. Mm-hmm. And, like, if she was wanting to get close to some other guy, it'd be some other form of manipulation. But that's what she's really good at. She's really good at extracting the maximum value from her Jon.
Sure. And I think there is a bit of insecurity here.
There
is
a bit of insecurity.
I mean, she is not...
There's also... I mean, that's why... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm trying to understand that from her position. Like, this is a precarious situation for her.
Right.
But it's really hard when it's couched in these terms.
And this is one of the... And honestly, this is one of the few forms of power women have in this particular
sure.
world. So I don't begrudge her for using it. But I just... Yeah, I just feel like she's... That none of this... Is I mean, that's the thing. She's a very confusing mix of a character because she's got some genuine affection and love and loyalty mm-hmm. for both Tyrion and Sansa, but she's also manipulating shit out of Tyrion. And that's the thing I keep coming to. Does she not believe Tyrion about how
right.
dangerous? Like, my father, have you heard the Reigns of Castamere? Mm-hmm. He doesn't say shit just to say it. And he said if any whore's caught in my bedroom, he'll hang her. And
yeah.
he will.
No, she doesn't. That's the thing. She doesn't seem... frankly smart enough to understand the danger she's in, and therefore I don't know that she's smart enough to entirely be manipulating Tyrion here. So I feel like part of this, a big part of it, is insecurity.
Do you think we're supposed to so I'm gonna try another tack here. Do you think that a way to understand this scene is, like, do you remember the scene with Ser Loras and Renly, where Renly is getting his chest shaved and mm-hmm. Loras is trying to push him into this idea of, oh, you could be a king. And then, like, you know, Renly's like, and Loras cuts him and is like, hey, it's just blood. You know, like, is this like Shay saying, like, you're an oppressive person. Why are you capped? Like, I'm not denying the danger. I'm saying that you are also dangerous and you could be running this thing. Like, she's trying to, like, push his ambition somehow. Because, like, imagine in a world where Tyrion would, like, rise up against Tywin and use his intellect and skills and connections. I don't even know if that's possible, but
right.
I wonder if Shay thinks... Just like Renly, maybe in retrospect, it's super
She's
foolish to
She's taken
he...
the long way around, because she never... In my mind, she never hints at that in this scene.
But if she... If Tyrion wants to protect her and she will not be assuaged... Or she will not be dissuaded from spending time with him, then maybe... Like I said... And the thing is that she can't be as bold as Ser Loras because she's not a man. So, like, maybe
sure.
that's her way of doing the same con.
Yeah. I don't know. I wasn't picking up those vibes from this scene. But maybe I'm biased.
This is what happens
because
when I watch an episode 8 times. I'm like, maybe I should... And yeah. But no, it's... it sucks for Tyrion, for sure. Except for the actual being sucked,
well,
I guess.
Yeah, that,
that's probably pretty good.
That part he probably enjoys.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we move on to Joffrey calling Margaery to his chambers to question her loyalty to the traitor, Renly, and why they never had a baby. She tells him it's because he wasn't interested in women, and the subject turns to his new crossbow, and he's about to take this on a hunt, and Marjorie uses this opportunity to earn his trust by faking excitement about the idea of killing things, essentially.
Yeah.
Playing into his bloodlust, his darker side. I gotta say, Jack Gleason, the guy playing Joffrey, does not get enough credit for playing a complete monster.
No.
Everybody looks at him and they go, oh, well. And tellingly, I don't think he's done anything since Game of Thrones.
Yeah,
became this character to such a degree that he either bowed out and was like, that's my magnum opus, or I don't know, maybe he can't get a job because everybody thinks of him as Joffrey.
I think I've read interviews where the experience not exactly soured him, but like he found it unpleasant.
I can imagine.
The reaction people had to him in public and like all that. And I agree. It is very, like, it's as hard to be this hateable as a villain as it is to be like a heroic. Like, I've seen lots of terrible, terrible villains on television and movies elsewhere. And he is just so, like, inspires so much intense feelings because he is. And you know, even knowing that Marge was going to walk out of the room, this is a scary scene.
Yeah.
Like, because you just know that if Marjorie doesn't walk this tightrope exactly so, that Joffrey will kill her.
Yeah. And worse. You know, he'll enjoy doing it.
Turn her into a new Sansa, where he's just, you know, she's going to be his pain puppet.
Or what he has Roz do, you know, to the other whore. Like, there's a lot of bad stuff that Joffrey can do to you that it isn't just killing you.
Right.
And
that's
always, especially in this scene, on the verge of doing it to you.
Yeah, no, he's crazy. And, like, I felt like she was really walking some minefields here because it wasn't super obvious what path to take. And she was very, like, let him take two steps to me, I'll take one step to him. And, like, oh, he is a homophobe, I'll go all in on the gay stuff.
Right.
But also try to maybe pump the brakes on it because, oh, shit, just get my brother in trouble later if we start outlawing sodomy in the land.
Right, which he's considered doing, as he talks about in this scene.
Right, not just outlawing, giving it the death penalty, Jesus Christ.
Yeah. But that's the thing about Jack Gleason's performance, and I guess the material itself, you know.
Right.
There are a lot of likable villains.
Right.
Like Loki from the Avengers. Like,
sure.
There are a bunch of people who walking down the street would not get tomatoes thrown at them.
Right.
Jack Gleason does not play that part in this show. He plays a true monster. Hateable character.
He's an irredeemable monster. Yeah, monster is the word for him.
And he does it so well.
Right.
So well.
And that's the other thing is, like, he's also, at one point, you know, it's kind of like, you know, Hitler loved dogs. At one point, he was a baby, an innocent, and he has been twisted by his circumstances and bad parenting and probably some fucked up genetics, if we're being honest, into this thing. And so he's not entirely unsympathetic because, my God, you saw his father, you saw his mother, you see his grandfather, his actual real father's as what? What would he even be? His own uncle? Uncle, father?
Dude, don't ask me who's related in Game of Thrones.
Yeah, the family tree just goes into like a little spin there.
That's not a fair question.
Yeah. So, but honestly, the other thing is, like, you don't feel really great about what Marge has to do here by the end of it because is she going to have to kill somebody or something? And she's going to have to pretend like she likes it? Also, we don't know enough about Marjorie. Maybe she really does. Like, I imagine there's more than one frustrated, like, Arya's not the only frustrated little girl who wants to kill things and be a warrior. Like, we know Brienne does, like, maybe. And I think there's some statements about Cersei being pissed that, like, she never got to be trained in arts and arms like Jaime was, even though she was essentially his twin. Well, not, he's literally his twin. So, like, maybe she wouldn't be opposed to getting her hands wet.
Well, I think you're right to point out, you know, how she has been so many other things that anything she pretends or anything she is in any scene is up for questioning.
Right.
Whether that's the true her or not. Because I don't see a woman who wants to go out and kill as the same woman who would comfort orphan children.
True. That's all, it's
and,
so
and stop in the streets at her own risk, you know, to do so.
Yeah.
So I think it's an act. That's what I assume. All right, we move on to Theon having the truth tortured out of him. And he admits to taking Winterfell to bring glory to his father and his house, which I guess seems to do something for his captors, because they sort of stop torturing and they leave at least. And then afterward, the person mopping the floors says that Yara, his sister, sent him, and he'll come back that night while everyone sleeps.
Good news. Good news. And he takes a couple turns off the foot press, too.
Yeah. Yeah. So a little bit of relief.
Yeah, but this, like, torturing is, like, you know, clearly... Like, it's funny because, like, Theon, I think, gets progressively more true in, like, what he's saying. But then at the end, you can see the downside of torture, which is your victim essentially will get to a point where they'll say anything and it doesn't really matter.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to question the motives and efficacy of the people that are torturing him and what they're trying to accomplish at this point.
Yeah. All right, then we move on to Jojen explaining to Bran a little bit about his powers. And we're not privy to that entire conversation because we go over to Asha trying to make fun of Jojen because he needs a sister to protect him, but Mira points out that Asha is essentially doing the same for Bran.
Right.
And then Jojen claims that he has the sight as well, which is the power that Bran has, and the only thing he's ever seen that matters is Bran, making him very important in Jojen's eyes.
Yeah, and we also are interested. We're introduced to this character, Howland Reed, which is notable because he was one of Ned's right hand men during Robert's Rebellion, mm-hmm. And served by his side with some distinction. And you know, one of the big enduring questions in Game of Thrones is: are we ever going to see Howland? Because he's mentioned, right. We know he's an important figure in Ned's past. Like, where will he ever show up?
And the way they're playing with time,
right?
In this scene here, where Jojen's saying, like, "Oh, I heard about this thing that happened a long time ago." He says he saw it.
Right. Like my dad never talked about it. Your dad did. I went back and took a peek.
It makes you wonder, like, when his father told him about Bran or whatever he says here. He says something about how he talked with Howland.
Mm-hmm.
But when did that happen? You know,
is
Howland out there? Is he dead? A lot of questions.
And the
scene.
Depth of affection, the fact that, like, Howland has heard of the death of Ned, probably by Raven, and grieved. When he heard about it. And the first time, that's something that, like, you imagine Howland is a stoic northerner like anybody else, and that's the first time Jojen's seen him cry. Like, it's a lot of, there's a deep relationship there. Will we get to explore it?
But that happened, what, years ago at this point?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like when Ned died?
Ned died
like a year, two years ago?
Man, that's a great question. Probably less than a year, I think, has elapsed.
This war is...
Right.
Has had to have taken a while.
Right. And that's the thing, because like, things are a lot more compressed in the books. I think in the TV show, because the kids are aging, like it's a little bit more flexible that like there's a little bit more time, but... I haven't looked into the timeline in a long time, but it wouldn't surprise me if someone could prove that this is only 3 months after Ned's death.
Right.
Because, you know, shit can happen fast, so.
All right, we go to the Brotherhood Without Banners, and everybody's having a meal. Thoros is questioning how the kids got out of Harrenhal, and Arya tries to demonstrate her swordsmanship, which doesn't go very well, and things get even worse when the Hound is dragged in, having been captured while passed out, and he outs Arya's true identity as a Stark girl.
Yeah, this is a scene that I think brought a lot of fanboys down to earth, because there was a lot of, like, you know, when, like, she gets her sword out and, like, starts doing her water dance or shit, it's like, no, this guy's twice her size and has been doing this since she was not even a gleam in Ned's eye. That's about right. Arya has a lot to learn before she gets to start working on her list.
Yeah, she may have learned from the water dancer, but
right.
Come on.
Yeah,
she's still a little girl.
She's still a little girl, and hasn't quite completed the training, as Yoda would say.
I do feel like it brings the Hound down a notch too. You know, he wasn't captured through a vicious battle or anything, but. You know, he gets too drunk. He passes out.
That seems like,
it's a weakness.
After he got scared of fire and said, fuck the king, and ran off in disgrace, and he was already visibly drunk when he went into Sansa's quarters and offered to save her, I could totally see him trying to drink away the pain and then just, you know, letting himself be captured. It does bring him down. But I don't know if it brings him down a notch or that's like the appropriate notch for him to be at.
Right.
He's certainly fearsome in his right mind, but there's lots of things that indicate that he hasn't been in his right mind.
Yeah. I wonder what they're going to do with the Hound now that they've caught him. Is this something where they're going to turn him in, get some kind of reward? Are they going to kill him for their own pleasures? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say too much because I know we haven't quite figured out the full extent of this Brotherhood Without Banners and who they're allegiant to and all that stuff. But
I'm just asking questions.
Just asking questions. Yeah, yeah. I mean, at this point, who wouldn't pay for the Hound? Like, I think Joffrey would like to get him back.
The Mountain probably would like to finish things once for all.
His hated brother, mutually. Uh-huh. Obviously, the Starks would want to bring, you know, one of these Lannister lieutenants and protectors down. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, he's doesn't have a lot of friendly roofs that he could rest his head under.
All right, and then in the final scene, Brienne tries to decide whether to navigate an open bridge while Jaime taunts her about it. When they finally do cross the bridge, Jaime steals one of Brienne's swords and they fight. And Brienne is unwilling to kill him, so they essentially fight to a standstill until some men approach. And they have the man who Brienne refused to kill earlier in the episode with them, and he IDs Jaime.
I'm really worried about this poor dude. I thought they were going to kill, like when they said give the man his gold, that they're just going to kill him.
Yeah.
But these are the expert hunters that Roose was speaking about. Mm-hmm. So they have done their job. It's interesting because you said they're fought to a standstill. I thought that's how I remembered this going too. But when I watched it, I remarked at how Brienne was kicking Jaime's ass at the end. Like she started very wary because this is Jaime fucking Lannister. He's the best sword in the kingdom. He's handcuffed, hasn't had a set sword in months. He's been underfed. His muscles atrophied.
He's covered in his own shit.
And there's a point in the middle where Jaime realizes, oh, shit, I can't beat this woman.
No, it's the moment when he tries to shoulder check her, and he ends up on his ass.
Yeah, busting in the face moment. With her gauntlet. And then then Brienne turns into Darth Vader on Bespin, where she's just parrying his blows effortlessly and taking it to him.
The reason I say a standstill here is because she can't kill him.
Yeah,
like,
right.
All she can do is like wait until he wears himself out.
Right. But that's the thing is, like, there were stakes in the beginning of this battle where Jaime's like, oh, what are you going to do? If you don't kill me, I'll kill you. And then it's like, Jaime's like, well, I can't do that. So I guess I'm just going to get beat by this great beast of a woman who moves well.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. And I also feel like that he's giving her some legit tips too, because like Brienne is certainly a force of nature, but I don't know that she is the most skilled of warriors. So like this whole thing about you shouldn't grimace before you lunge. Yeah, you shouldn't. You shouldn't fail a grave. I feel like that's going to make her a better warrior going down the line.
Yeah, it does feel like Jaime without the handcuffs. That's what I want to see.
Yeah.
Because it does feel like Jaime has this sort of almost like a, you know, Cyril Ferrell kind of style where he's about finesse. He's about position and that kind of thing. Whereas Brienne seems to be about brute strength and size.
And I think also Jaime spent a lot of time just fucking around, like just I'm gonna enjoy cutting this woman down like a tree, and just fucking with her, and then realize his tank was half empty and he's a little rusty, and just like it's a really Game of Thrones is not short of its action scenes, but what I really like how they do is they tell a story, like the same way that like Jaime and Ned's fight in season one told a story. The same way, like the Battle of the Blackwater told a story, like this told this really interesting story with like a surprise twist in the middle, and it's like a play in three acts. It's really good, and also it's also because, you know, we've been talking about like how politically fucked Rob is. This is kind of like a gut check for that, because we see like a tertiary bannerman of his being bribed by a Lannister, and all that means is like, are you fucking kidding me? I'm like the king of the North will have my head. So like, if Karr Stark's position is he's already lost a war, the people under the people of Rob haven't gotten a memo yet.
Right.
And they still believe in the cause. So,
and this is a huge moment for Rob.
Right.
Recapturing Jamie Lannister. You know, he's correcting the mistake his mother made.
Yeah.
They have leverage again.
This would smooth so many things. I mean, they're still boned from a numerical standpoint, but this would really solidify his power and get him prestige back in the eyes of his men. But
especially with the person we've pointed out as the military leader, Tywin.
Yeah.
Who, this is his golden child, right? Like, he has no other male sons. Sons are always male by definition.
Right.
His eyes.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, Tyrion is not a candidate for anything. So he, I believe, prizes Jaime.
Oh, yeah.
Even though he's, you know, the Kingsguard and he can't inherit lands or titles or anything like that.
No, I think Tywin's one bad cough away from figuring out a way to lean against the High Septon to, like, find something in the Book of the Seven to explain how a Kingsguard can renounce his oaths and re-inherit lands and all that. Yeah.
Right.
Like, he comes down with a cough and that's it. Like whoever the High Septon is will be replaced until there's the High Septon that will be amenable to that change, because that's got to be his plan.
Yeah, I mean, Jaime in this scenario very much feels like the queen on the chessboard.
Yeah,
and they just captured it.
Unless Tywin's going to find another wife and get to making more babies. I don't see him having the patience
marry
for that.
Him.
Yeah,
I don't see the women having the patience for him. Frankly,
I don't know. I wonder how he'd feel about it, because if Joff maintains the throne, we know his little brother's Tommen. I wonder how he'd feel. Maybe Tywin's long term plan is to put Tom, but I don't. What does Tywin believe about the situation with Jaime and Cersei? Because I wonder what Tywin think about putting. Because if he knows about it, maybe he feels good. But I don't know that he. I mean, Tommen's a Baratheon.
Mm-hmm.
Like, nah, no way, no way. Probably something through his brother Kevin, and maybe fucking Lancel.
Anybody with the name Lannister,
right?
I think he'd be okay with.
Right, yeah. Except for unless it's Tyrion.
Oh, well, of course, yeah. Tyrion doesn't exist to him. And that's the end of the episode.
That is the end of the episode.
It's a good one.
Before we get to feedback, I'd like to take this opportunity to reflect on why we are in the middle of a massive Game of Thrones content drought where people aren't paying attention about this subject, and it probably doesn't make good business sense to do it. Why are we releasing Game of Thrones season 3? Well, because we like Game of Thrones, and we're kind of feeling the effects of the drought, and we do this full time, so we can do whatever the hell we want. And the reason we can do it full time and do what we want is because our listeners allow us that leeway to do so through the club, by supporting us through the club, club.baldmove.com. It's a great way to keep us doing the cool things that you like for us to do, and you can get some really cool stuff for yourself. We've got to help me out here, ad-free feeds, so you never have to hear me pitch this goddamn club again.
My favorite, Lunch with Jim and Aaron
every Friday at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard. We get together, people ask us questions on Twitter and on the forum, and we answer them live, and we have a good time doing it. It's like a little variety show. We got first run bald movies with spoilers. We got Quit Your Pitching and video game playthroughs and all kinds of extra bonus content. Most of our podcasts we record live on video, so you can actually watch it. You don't have to wait for us to produce it and release it later. All pretty cool, and it can be yours by going to club.baldmove.com. Support us. Get some cool stuff for yourself. Win-win. Club.baldmove.com.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues, but then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question: who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. First two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th,
Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
We have a bit of non-spoiler feedback to consider before we get into the spoilery stuff, and we got quite a bit of that. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com is where you want to send that. I'm also trolling the forums. I got a couple forum feedbacks this week, too. Gabe. Did I say the forums? Forums.baldmove.com? Game of Thrones at baldmove.com, forums.baldmove.com. Gabe. Hey, guys. I may have missed this at some point, but just curious if Aaron's new religious book will be available on audiobook in the somewhat near future. As a dad of two little kids, there's no way I could actually have time to pick up and read a physical book. But audiobooks are easy. Just curious. I would like to do that, and we're going to set up a stretch goal hopefully this week to like try to raise funds for that. But it's tough because like what I want to do is go through the ACX, which is the Amazon Creative Exchange, and like actually have it professionally produced, and whether I read it or someone else reads it, like, you know, have that professional production so it looks and sounds and works as an audiobook and has whisper sync and all that kind of stuff. If we can't do that, I could see myself actually releasing an informal audiobook, which will just be essentially a series of podcasts that I give to, you know, people who maybe we could sell this on a Bald Move site or something. It would just be like a collection of podcasts where I just read the chapter with the gear that we've got and make it that way. But I want to make that happen, not just for guys like you and gals in your situation, but I know for a fact we have a few blind fans because they've actually reached out and talked to me. And I'd feel, you know, just from an accessibility standpoint, I think that would that'd be cool. But yeah, if you guys want to check that out, once again, book.baldmove.com. We're funded. That's cool. Yeah. Now we're seeing like if we can raise money to make it even cooler. So Mike from St. Louis was recently watching some Game of Thrones and South Park episodes with Game of Thrones and Star Wars themes and got to thinking, would you cheer on and appreciate it in the future if HBO allowed someone to go back and add more direwolf scenes to existing Game of Thrones episodes, or would that be blasphemy? It'd be rough to do without existing scene, or it'd be rough to do existing scenes without reshoots, which would be impossible with the aging of some of the cast. But I would say most of us want more direwolves scattered throughout the series, like Grey Wind and some of the Stark Lannister battles, and of course more ghost. Is this hope more or less likely than Gurm finishing the books?
More.
Yeah. I mean, first of all, you'd have to get actual Stark Lannister battles that weren't just like, you know, lead up, fade to black, aftermath with some dude screaming. Yeah. You'd actually have to go back and film some of those battles. But, yeah, man, can you imagine how cool it'd be to see the Battle of Whispering Woods with Grey Wind? He's almost the size of Rob's horse riding beside him, just tearing Lannister men in half. Mm-hmm. That would be fucking cool. And the guy who's the guy that plays Rob Stark, because I think that like most of, as I was thinking about like most of the cool scenes involving like most of the cool scenes involving like Ghost involved Jon Snow, and Kit Harington could go do reshoots, and he looks like Kit Harington. He hasn't aged a lot. The guy to play, I thought it was Richard Madison. Yeah, this guy, Richard Madden. I just looked at a current picture of him, and he hasn't changed a lot. So I think you could do it. I just... Well, here's the other thing. Stanky taking over HBO Creative. I could see him like, hey, special edition Game of Thrones. Let's sell another set of Blu-rays. Let's re-release them and get another 100 million people watching it. Like, I
Game of Thrones special editions?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah. You know, what would be the Han Drew for like
replace Reigns of Castamere with
Ned
the Ewok
Drew first?
Song.
he got his head out from the block and killed Ser Ilyn Payne right on the dais and swashbuckled his way and rescued Arya, and they get Sean Bean back, and it's a complete reimagining of the series. Yeah, I don't see that happening. As
no.
cool as it sounds, sorry to be Dasher of Dreams here. And that's it for the non-spoiler feedback.
Wow.
And yeah, we typically, this is how it goes. It's the tip of the iceberg, and then we get to the rest of the iceberg and the spoiler. But if you haven't watched past Season 3, Episode 2, and you haven't read the books, now's the time for you to turn off your podcast, because we're going to get spoilery. You're going to be talking about the entire series, everything that's been publicly released by HBO, including, like, four more episodes, four more seasons of television, and several more books. So turn it off now, and let's get into the spoiler section. Did you have some things you want to talk about spoilery before we got to the email?
The only thing that I really noticed, I guess, I mean, there are a million things to talk about, but
yeah.
One of the things I noticed is, and I can't remember if this is a spoiler or not, but they sort of hint here with the camera in this first scene when Bran wakes up from his dream that, you know, him and Rickon might be seeing the same thing.
Hmm.
And I know that's something that in the books they make a lot more explicit, right? Like that all of the Stark children have some kind of powers here. And it's something during the watching of the show up to this point that I had not got from it.
I wish I could. I'd like to go back and watch that scene again, because I wasn't looking for that. But you're right.
Because when he wakes up, like the dogs are staring at him.
Yeah.
And Rickon wakes up in the same manner
and
looks over at Bran.
I think that. I mean, it's a canon fact in the books that all the Stark children have these at least wolf dreams, except for Sansa, because Lady gets killed too soon for the magic to reawaken or whatever ends up binding these Stark children to their wolves. But, like, Arya, like, sees Nymeria rampaging through the Riverlands, and she actors that one gruesome scene where she sees Nymeria, like, worrying a corpse out of the river that we then find out becomes Catelyn Stark's reborn body. Lady Stoneheart, Rickon has wolf dreams. You know, Jon obviously, unconsciously wargs into the ghost a few times. There's hints that one of the reasons Robb is so good at battle is because he uses Grey Wind again instinctually, not consciously, to like scout out the battlefield, and those wolf senses kind of like meld into his. So that'd be really cool, because that has largely been dropped from the plot of the show.
Yeah, they're very subtle with it when they do it. Like there's some stuff with Jon when he dies later on where like Ghost is sort of acting weird,
and that was like before season 6 of Game of Thrones. That one of the popular theories, it was like the ghost as a refrigerator for Jon's soul.
Right.
That like Jon was going to, at the moment of death, warg, and that's going to be the way that he gets around the whole like you lose a bit of yourself when you die. That he's going to warg his entire consciousness into. And in fact, that might be how it happens in the books. But he's going to warg his consciousness into Ghost, and then when his body gets resurrected, has complete consciousness downloaded back, so that he can still be like recognizably Jon Snow, but still have, you know, this miraculous kind of white like resurrection. But they don't. Yeah, I want to watch that scene again before next week and see what I think, because that would be a cool detail. I want to talk about Jojen saying the three-eyed raven is you. We later find out the three-eyed raven is a different dude, and I guess Bran eventually becomes a three-eyed raven, but I feel like Jojen is shading the truth just a little bit by saying, I mean, that's certainly what he becomes, but it's not what he is now.
But has he seen the future?
I guess that's the excuse for everything, right?
Yeah, seeing the entire timeline, he would he would not make that distinction.
They're like those
I
fucking
guess.
Six-dimensional dudes from Interstellar, they just experience, or right. or like the Arrival, where they just they can't past, present, future. It's like all one big thing laid out before them. So yeah. he's speaking everything in the present sense. All right, I'll retract that comment. One other thing I want to talk about is I remember it being a huge topic, the whole Theon torturing, and how it just seemed to go on forever. And I was wanting to keep track this season, much like we did with the, you know, Where Are My Dragons last year? Like, I want to do the Theon torture scenes to see, because, like, right now we're up to two. We had the knife under the fingernail, and we had the foot screw. I want to see if that was as big a deal as people made it out to be, because as we saw at the Where Are My Dragons, that was something that was certainly a part of the season, but not as big as you thought. It what I think we realized what happened is that was the Where Are My Dragons was in every previously on. It was in all the trailers. So when you think back on that season, you think it's just Danny walking around, Where Are My Dragons? Where am I? When that really literally only happens 1.5 times. Mm-hmm. So I'm keeping a Theon torture count, and it stands at two scenes.
Two scenes? Are we...
Yeah.
There are two in this episode.
That's what I'm saying. There's two scenes.
Isn't there one last episode?
Uh-uh. We didn't see Theon. Last time I saw Theon, he was getting smashed in the head by the Ironborn as they were...
You're right.
They were doing the 23 Skidoo out of Winterfell.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he's been tortured twice.
Okay.
Because I remember, like... trying to figure out, like, why. I mean, I think part of this is the Double D's kind of do have a prurient interest in this. They like this gross shit. They like dwelling on the unpleasant parts of Game of Thrones for all kinds of reasons. And I'm not saying that's bad. Like, you know, Eli Roth has got his crazy fucked up shit that he likes to delve into, and a lot of people like it.
Yep.
It just, I remember being the visceral reaction from fan base being too much torture. We get it. He's being tortured. He's being broken.
Yeah. I do feel like there's a certain amount that they needed to do to truly sell it to me.
Because they do, I think that maybe when you're watching this the first time, you think that this is, I don't know what, but when you think of it in terms of, like, they're breaking down this very proud, arrogant person that we met in season one and two, and refashioning him in a brainwashing capacity as this subservient, almost subsentient, subservient creature. Maybe it's going to be warranted, but it's a conversation I'd like to continue to have in hindsight. Mm-hmm. Anything else you want to talk about?
Nope.
Forward-looking? Okay, let's get back into the stuff. I want to talk about some stuff that we left from last episode, because we had talked about how we weren't sure if Jaime would survive because he had the tone for his sins. Mm-hmm. And we had some people on the forums take exception to that. Hatorian says, I was listening to your podcast. You guys mentioned Jaime need to pay for his sins regarding Bran. However, neither of you guys mentioned that Jaime was severely punished for his crimes. He was captured, jailed, and humiliated by Rob's army. He got his sword arm cut off. It's eye for an eye, but I guess losing one hand and still being able to walk isn't as bad as losing the ability to walk. But I'm fairly confident Jaime has been punished enough that we can see him as his... at least a true neutral or closer to good than evil. And RK Croft mentioned, I can't say whether Jaime needs to pay more than he has, but I also want to point out that he lost all three of his children. And he's lost his father. He's lost his brother, or at least the affectionate relationship they had. He's lost the love and affection.
Yeah.
The love of his life, Cersei. And to reveal that maybe she never really felt that way about him the whole time. I still don't know if it's enough. It's certainly more than I was probably giving it, like, a second thought on the podcast the last time. But I still, that's a lot. That's a lot. But certainly not everything has been taken from him at this point.
Not quite. He still has his life.
Feels like a self-sacrifice is what. And maybe he tried to do that last year when he threw himself at Dany's dragons. Like, that was his heart, you know, like, moment of altruism or something. I don't know. But those good points, you two. Does that change your mind at all?
I mean, I think I've always been a little more moderate on that idea that Jaime needs to suffer more. You know, I pointed out that he's had his reputation entirely destroyed as well.
Sure. Right.
Those sorts of things. I don't think Jaime is quite as villainous. Yes, he does a very villainous thing in pushing Bran, but I don't think he's quite the villain that everyone wants to make him out to be. Yeah. He's certainly no Joffrey.
I also don't know how, honestly, Jamie views his children. Because I know he had a nice, like, a tender scene with Marcella that was, like, a book, so far a show-only thing. But that, I think, is the first time that he... There might have been a scene with a Tommen, too, where he tries to be something... Or I know there was a scene where he became Lord Commander of the Kingsguard, where he tried to give Joffrey some good advice, and Joffrey's like, well, you don't know a fucking thing. You're done. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
So, or maybe that happens after he gets his arm cut off and he comes back. Yes. Because he hasn't, yeah, he's been out in the wind ever since shit went down at King's Landing. So, that's the other thing. It's like, yeah, he has lost his kids, but how does Jaime feel about that? And not just show Jaime, but book Jaime, which is what we're, you know, ultimately... I do think one of the bullet points that Martin gave the Double D's, if they care to follow it, is that, you know, Jamie dead or alive.
Yeah.
Like, some of the bullet points got to be just like a list of 25 characters and thumbs right. up, thumbs down, you know. But we'll see. Lauren M., when we first meet Olenna Tyrell, she mentions she tried to warn her son and Margaery about tying their fates to Renly, who she claimed was treasonous to think that he could be king. My question is, don't you think she knew exactly what she was doing? The entire point of the Queen of Thrones, besides doling out amazing one-liners, is to advance the Tyrell family. Do you think she was banking on Renly winning, or the fact that he might lose anyway and her family could continue to climb the ladder of chaos? That's that's a great question I was trying to get at in our discussion about, you know, Is she the power behind Highgarden? Is she more of a subtle manipulator that tries her best, but ultimately her fat-headed offspring just kind of do whatever, blunder into their own little cliffs chasing falcons? Like,
Not even as clever as she seems. You know, maybe she only realized in hindsight that it was a bad idea to tie their fate to these treasonous, you know, upstarts.
Right.
And is trying to play it off.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh, I told him all along.
Or maybe she thought
a bad idea.
She thought that was the best play and it didn't work, so now she's working the next best play as much as she can.
It does make me question a little bit. That's a really good point.
Right. Let's see. Amber from Florida. While it was extremely enjoyable to see Jaime and Brienne together again, as well as the origination point of the Arya and Hound roadshow. Yeah, this is the this is the genesis. I think the thing that stood out to me the most on this episode was the introduction of Jojen Reed. On my first watch, I was distracted by wondering who the hell this kid was, but on my rewatch, he literally answers a question that viewers are debating many seasons later. He tells Bran that he can not only see the future, but also the present and past. My question is, how much does the book answer for us about Jojen and why he is sent to Bran in the first place? The show says that he's basically a vessel to get Bran into the tree. He knows that he's going to die, but he knows that Bran's mission is of utmost importance, so he doesn't care. Mm-hmm. Do we know more on how he became a Green Seer in the first place? Why him? And do you think we will ever see Mira again in season 8, or will their last awkward goodbye be it for her?
Ooh, I just thought of a way that Jojen might not actually know what happens to Bran, that he becomes the Three-Eyed Raven.
How's that?
If he can't see the future beyond his own death.
Oh, that's a common, like, sci-fi fantasy trope.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe you are right to question that, but yeah.
It's interesting because in the books, Jojen doesn't get fireballed to death outside of the cave. He actually makes it in there, but he has kind of like this Christ in the Garden of Gethsemane where, like, you know, Christ is sweating blood and begging for this cup to be turned from him. And Jojen doesn't do that, but he's withdrawn and sullen because he knows that I think that he's going to die. Mm. And he doesn't actually die in the books. We don't think, but there is the implication that not only was he murdered by the Children of the Forest, but they then used his blood to mix up with some weirwood paste, and they fed it to Bran to kind of, like, awaken Bran's green-seeing abilities.
Okay.
Again, this is all implication. This is some stuff that I delve into in the book that I'm writing. I think that he knows, and, like, as he gets closer to the point of his death, because I think he's pretty cavalier about it and like, oh yeah, I'm, you know, doing this thing and I'm making a sacrifice and all this, and I know that today, and he's also, I'm not going to die today no matter how bad things will look because I've seen my death and this ain't it.
Right.
But then when he gets to the cave, he's like, oh, this is it, and he starts being sullen, withdrawn, and starting to longing for home, and yeah, and then maybe gets ground up in the paste and fed to his little friend here.
Wow.
So yeah, that was his purpose, and that's also, you know, whether you believe that the Jojen paste theory is true or not, it's still pretty dark that the three-eyed raven uses children in this way. Like, he's very much not giving a shit about any earthly concerns other than whatever his objective is, to maybe defeat the others, maybe, I don't know, return balance to the Force. We're not quite sure exactly what the office of the three-eyed raven is actually trying to do. But yeah, and also it's interesting because in the books from Melisandre's visions, we get the idea that like the three-eyed raven represents death and kind of serves the others, but maybe because he taps into that cold magic that it's like, she can't tell the difference because her fire magic sees that all as evil. And I mean, right. There's so many questions about the magic of this world.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, I doubt we'll ever get satisfying questions from the show. Maybe the books though. Melanie G, so I was always had the feeling that the scene between Marjorie and Joff, where she strokes his crossbow and asks if he'd like to see her kill something, is tied to Roz's death by crossbow and Joff's chambers a bit later. It seems like maybe we're being set up to think that Marjorie helped Joff kill Roz. Baelish seems to back this up with his creepy, breathy description of how he needed to shed an underperforming asset while he had a client who wanted to try something new, that leads up to us seeing dead Roz tied to the bedpost. I never made that connection, but by God, that is a hell of a connection to make, and I'm going to be looking at the sequence of events to see if there's room for that. Because, yeah, that does seem like a valid implication, right?
I mean, the implication here is that she just encouraged his bloodlust and that led to it, or that she directly had a hand in arranging that.
Oh, well, no, that I think. So the thing I know that happened on the show is that Peter Baelish, you know, Varys tries to turn Roz as an asset against Baelish. Baelish gets wind of it and then offers him up as a sacrifice to Joffrey. Now, did Joffrey come to Uncle Baelish and say, hey, want to kill one of your sex workers, Uncle Baelish? And he's like, sure, I got to know just the girl. Or did Baelish, much like a lot of people speculated, got in his ear about Ned? Did he get in his ear and be like, hey, I notice you like killing small kittens and shooting, but have you ever killed a real, you know, have you ever hunted the most dangerous game? Like, I don't know, but then that's a separate question of, would Joffrey pull in Marjorie? And I guess, why wouldn't he? Unless he's just not that confident in his psychopathy. Like, yeah, we're talking about a great hunt, but I don't know if I trust my queen with this truth about me yet.
Right. I'm seeing two dots to connect, but they're very far apart at this moment.
Yeah. I will be watching when this happens to see, to see if there is little evidence here or there, because boy, that really puts a really dark spin on Marjorie.
It would, yeah.
Holy shit. Sean McGee, in your 301 recap spoiler section, you talk about how, at least in the show, the three dragons theory is dead because of one of the dragons being dead. But I'm not so sure. Yes, there are two living dragons and one undead dragon, but there are also two living Targaryens, if Tyrion is one, in Dany and Tyrion, and one undead Targaryen in the form of Jon Snow.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty... And I got really excited when I read this email, and I'm like, oh my god, I couldn't remember which of the dragons died. Is it Viserion or if it's Rhaegal? Because if it's Rhaegal, the namesake of Jon's father that died, like, oh man, I'm getting super excited, but unfortunately it's Viserion, the namesake of Dany's shit brother. But yeah, it's still pretty cool. You're right. It doesn't really break the you know, they'd have to wrest control of this undead dragon from the Night King, but why couldn't an undead king, you know, of the North ride an undead dragon?
Yeah, I guess I'm always skeptical of these sort of cutesy feeling matchups that people come up with, but
If it just happened...
I don't see a reason not
like, if no one had told you about it and it happened... That's how I try to the judge this. If I didn't know about it and it happened on the screen, would I be clapping in delight, or would I be like,
right.
I kind of feel like I'd be clapping in delight.
Yeah, I just wonder if the magics are compatible. Like, he's brought back by the fire magic.
Right.
Could he ride the ice dragon?
But see, that goes to the core of this other question we asked, like... Is the fire magic just the opposite side of the ice magic? Is it a different way to manifest? Like,
what's the nature of a song of ice and fire? Right,
right, exactly. Let's see. Quinn G. My question is a follow-up on the Tyrion possibly being a Targaryen theory that you mentioned in the last podcast. People love this theory, and while I can see it being possible, the only problem I had and can't find any evidence to deny is the fact that Tyrion is the youngest. Jaime and Cersei were the first. So if the Mad King did take rights, or his first rights, improprieties, that would mean Jaime and Cersei would be the Targaryens and make Tyrion Tywin's only true son, which I also love so much more. With this being said, do you know of any evidence that says Jaime and Cersei were born when Tywin wasn't married and that Tyrion was there first after the marriage? That's an interesting question because, believe it or not, Jaime and Cersei being secret Targaryens is also one of the theories, because right there in the text, there is Barristan Selmy saying, oh yeah, your father kind of really boned over Tyrion or took some untoward improprieties with Tywin's wife on their wedding night. So a lot of, like I said, this kind of theory has kind of been raging back and forth. It's interesting, a couple years back when World of Ice and Fire came out, there's a particular passage that was new information where Martin carefully crafted a timeline to bring Joanna Lannister, Tywin's wife, back into Aerys's court approximately a year before we know that Tyrion was born. Which a lot of people see as, like, you know, because Martin is aware of this meta discussion.
Yeah.
Like, why the fuck would you put that in there if not to try to smooth the timelines to make, to at least keep the smokescreen nice and thick?
Right.
So I'm not saying it's a fact. I'm saying that there's evidence that Martin wants us to think it's a fact because he constructed a timeline that he had full control over after he'd written all this stuff. And for what purpose to do that, rather than to leave open the idea that Tyrion might be the illegitimate son of Aerys Targaryen? Let's see. Brian R. We know after this episode, Ramsay is going to amp up his torture. So if you were Ramsay, what three items would you use to torture Theon? My choice is orange juice, toothpaste, and a towel. I'd make Theon brush his teeth and then waterboard him with orange juice. The reason I picked this is because he believes in the drowned god, and I could break him by simulating drowning in the most awful way possible.
This is what drowning tastes like.
That's right. It tastes like... What is it about toothpaste and orange juice, man?
I don't know. Something about the acidity and the mintiness.
It's bad.
It's real bad.
It's like it destroys the flavor of orange juice, and to drowned in that way would be... I don't know that I can come up with anything better than that, honestly.
No, that's really good. Certainly not thematically more appropriate.
Because the other thing is, like, I don't know how you can break a person faster. Like, just unending, capricious torture to reduce. Because, like, it does seem like it's not great for extracting intelligence, but it is great for just turning a person into, like, the bestial, you know, like a not fully human thing anymore. So
I mean, I think, you know, I don't want to take anything away from Ramsay. He does a hell of a job, both effective wise and also thematic. I mean, he takes Theon's favorite thing to do, which is screw.
Right.
He screws him through the foot. He tortures him with wieners, with sausages.
Mm-hmm.
It's Theon's prized possession.
Right.
I can't think of the third one.
So you just use foot screws, dicks, sausages, and...
There's got to be a good one out there.
It's got to be.
Maybe the person who came up with the orange juice torture could write in.
He used women to torture him, too, like right before he did.
They do, yeah.
Because I'm trying to think, like, what is the other thing that... Because Theon, he's a randy little dude, but he's also covetous of power. Like, I wonder if there's any way you could torture him with that, like, psychological piece nugget.
Yeah.
But yeah, I would not want to fall on your hands, Brian R. That's some creative some creative fucking torture right there. Let us move on. Shaka C. You both have spent some time talking about Jamie's redemptive arc and the idea that he's still not really had a reckoning for the attempted murder of Bran. In the season 7 finale, we see Jamie leave Cersei and head north, presumably to Winterfell. This sets up a face-off that I'm really looking forward to when Bran and Jamie see each other for the first time since the fall. I'm curious how Jamie will handle that.
Man, I think Bran's over it. Bran's like, dude, I got such bigger concerns than my stupid legs.
Yeah, I can fly now. I can transcend time and space.
I don't think Bran holds against him.
I can creep out every female within 50 miles.
Easily.
A 50-mile radius, apparently.
And the males.
Everybody. But I really like making weird comments to my sister about her wedding night, and I really like making one of my fast friends who I've been through many adventures with feel like I'm an uncaring monster.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to let her continue. Along these same lines, I was also... Actually, I'm not sure if Shaka is a man or if a woman. I'm sorry if I misgendered you. Along the same lines, I also was hoping you guys could clarify for both book and show if it's common knowledge that Jaime pushed Bran. I know in the books he's confessed to Catelyn, I believe in front of Brienne, so presumably Cat and Brienne knew. And if I remember correctly, Bran eventually recalls, so that's maybe two of three people. In the show, Rob accuses Jamie of it when he's his prisoner, but otherwise I don't think it's directly addressed. Are we to assume it's common knowledge in either case at this point? If not, specifically on the show, do you think this revelation will be used as a major point of contention if Jamie tries to ally himself to Starks? I can see Arya in particular taking a hard line over it. I can also see it as being the final straw that crushes any possibility of a Jamie-Brienne romance that many people seem to want. I am not one of those people. Good question. Hmm. I haven't really scoured the tomes for evidence of Bran being how common a knowledge it was, because certainly it was a theory that Kat was chasing down, and you know, with her CSI Winterfell investigation, she told Ned, but you know, Ned got killed. Like, I honestly don't know.
I'm not sure.
I think the rumors of the Lannister incest probably sucked a lot of oxygen from that particular fire, even if it was kind of like common knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
But regardless, I at this point, Bran either knows or could know at any time he chooses to. Like, if he saw Jaime, I bet the first thing his mind snaps back to is being thrown out of the tower. You know?
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. Like, he can access infinite timelines, but unless he knows where to look, he doesn't.
I guess so.
So,
seems to be how they're playing it.
I'm with Jim, though. I don't think it's going to be like a big, you know, they're not going to face off and start hissing at each other.
Bran's changed so much.
Yeah, and not all for the better.
No, I mean, he's just unconcerned with those types of things anymore, I believe.
Yeah. Kevin R., after hearing your comments about the season six and season 3 episode 1 podcast, I felt compelled to email you. Did we talk a bunch of shit about season 6?
Yeah, we might have ranked the seasons.
I think we tried.
That's what we did.
I remember talking shit about season 5, but I don't remember talking shit about season 6. Maybe we did.
I don't know.
Season 6 stands out as one of my favorite Game of Thrones seasons, just like season 4. If you think about it, there's a ton of action that happens in season 6, much like season 4. Standout episodes include The Door. That's, you know, the origin of Hodor. Battle of the Bastards needs no introduction. And what many people consider the best episode of all time, The Winds of Winter. That's where Cersei blows up everything and settles all family business, very Michael Corleone type.
Mm-hmm.
On top of those great episodes, we also got the Jon Snow resurrection, one of the first Stark reunions, Jon and Sansa, Dany taking out the Khals and gaining control of the Dothraki. The only real low point for the season for me is how they handled the Arya and the Faceless Men. But after considering all this, do you really think season 6 was that weak? No.
I guess not, yeah.
I would put it a notch below season 3 and 4, and maybe... Well, I don't... Because 2's good. It's good because it's Tyrion at the height of his powers, and then you got the Blackwater.
Mm. Yeah.
And season 1 is amazing because it was my first experience of Game of Thrones, and, like, you know... I was spoiled for the Red Wedding, but I wasn't for Ned, and I was, like, blown away when his head rolled off.
Yeah.
Like, not since the climax of fucking Braveheart have I been that just like, the fuck did I just see? So, yeah, I think 6 is right up there. It's just a notch below because it does have, like, Arya surviving her swimming in sewer water after having open stomach surgery is a bit of bullshit.
Yeah.
It felt self-inflicted bullshit, too. Like, they didn't have to go that way. They just did it.
I'm sure there was a bunch of Dorn stuff in there, too, that was just like...
Yeah, but it was all kind of like, I feel like the Double D's got the menu about... Or the menu, the memo about Dorn, and kind of like is already shying away from that. Mm-hmm. Like, season 5's peak Dorn, oh my god, yeah. What the hell is this?
It is.
So, yeah, no, season 6, in retrospect, is not... Like, I would not say it's a weak season. I would say the weak seasons are 5 and half a 7.
Mm-hmm.
So, let's move on. Nathan T, after listening to your season 3 episode 1 rewatch podcast, you use Roose Bolton's line, "The Lannisters send their regards," as the punchline to your sisters / only cats line edits, as in, what if they change that line from the books? The ironic thing is that they did in fact change that line. In the books, it's Jaime Lannister sends his regards, since Jaime in fact tells Roose to give his regards to the King of the North. I imagine Jaime Lannister sends his regards will play a major role in the upcoming Winds of Winter, since it's one of the last things Catelyn hears in life before her resurrection, and in time for the 6th book, she currently holds Jaime hostage. I'm pretty sure the Double D's knew they weren't going to go with Lady Stoneheart's plotline as far back as season 3, and therefore decided to broaden the gut punch to all the Lannisters, especially since Jaime clearly has no role in the Red Wedding. I guess...
Could be.
That's different than your sister Cat, because it's a change that has a discernible effect, whereas
right,
you know, your sister just like doesn't trust the audience to keep track of this incredibly complex character plot season 5 when Baelish throws her out the window. It is, yeah.
Jesus.
Maybe?
I
because the pursuit is so sick.
I couldn't tell you.
Sansa escapes after Purple Wedding, and I think she's taken to, yeah, I think mm-hmm. that happens in season 4. So I guess that's the, and you know, I, at the time, you could listen to podcasts, I wasn't that outraged. I don't think it's as good a line or a clean as line. I don't know why they did it, but I do think it's different from saying only Jaime Lannister versus like, or I'm sorry, saying Jaime Lannister sends his regards and Lannister sends his regards.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think anyway, but you are correct, Nathan T. Last one, Rebecca from Colorado. During your coverage of Season 7, Episode 4, you had some feedback about how Davos was acting weirdly towards Missandei, and how the butterflies must be beautiful on Narth, which we know, like, the whole background here is that Davos says that to Missandei, and the joke is that the butterflies in her homeland of Narth are actually poisonous. I have another interpretation of the scene. There's a theory I heard, maybe even from this podcast, though I can't remember, that states Missandei is a spy in Dany's camp. Some theories go so far as to say she's a faceless man. If that's the case, maybe Davos has a weird feeling about her, and we've more or less been testing her. Like, Narth, I've never been. I've heard it has awesome butterflies, and when she didn't even give him a weird look about how deadly they are, this solidified his thoughts.
Oh yeah, this is the Man in Black Emily theory. Sure.
Well,
Davos,
I mean,
is a robot.
If you remember in season 7, there was a big debate about who was the spy in Dany's camp, because
sure.
the Lannisters kept outmaneuvering her, and there's certainly no shortage of possible targets, because Varys is kind of unhappy, Tyrion is kind of unhappy, a lot of people were unhappy with the way things were going.
And Tyrion was meeting with Lannisters.
Meeting Lannisters. Do you think that's actually a plot that they'll pick up and do anything with?
That's a really good question. This goes back to the, well, they can't do everything, so they can't do anything syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
But does it feel important enough to do something with? I think maybe. Maybe that does.
Because there's also a lot of talk about Dany losing her mind and going full Mad King or Mad Queen, and Missandei being revealed as treacherous after that speech she gives about us choosing the queen and she wasn't forced on her or anything like that. I could see that really shaking Dany to her core foundations and reevaluating how she feels about humanity in general.
Yeah.
So maybe if it's Missandei,
we'll see.
I don't know. Sure. This feels like a little bit of like kind of slightly weak evidence though, but we'll see, because that is definitely kind of a thread that's been dangling. And that's it. That's it for the feedback. That's it for a podcast. Next week, I predict we're going to be pretty light on feedback, because we're having to record this way in advance, because we're going to be gone next week at this podcast movement, professional expo podcast thing in Philadelphia. So we'll probably be pretty light on feedback, which means we'll have an extra heavy feedback when we get back for episode 304. But we will have 303 out on the regularly scheduled time, if not slightly before. Thanks for coming along. on the rewatch with us. Really appreciate all the participation and feedback. It's good to be back. Until we see you next time, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Later.